said recently exhausted hospital workers will be getting some help from 1,050 National Guard troops, including 150 nurses, emergency medical technicians and others with medical training. The Center for Disease Control and Prevention, the CDC, released a new test-to-stay strategy on Friday that allows unvaccinated children to remain in school even if they're exposed to the virus. The protocol is intended to replace the automatic quarantines, which have required tens of thousands of students to miss school days this fall. A federal appeals court has reinstated U.S. President Joe Biden's controversial vaccine or testing COVID-19 mandate for large companies, a requirement that has been decried as an unlawful overreach by the federal government. The U.S. Court of Appeals for the Sixth Circuit on Friday, 17th of December, removed an earlier stay by another court which had blocked the nationwide mandate from taking effect. The requirement, issued by the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, had mandated that businesses with at least 100 employees require staff to receive a jab or be tested weekly or face penalties of nearly $14,000 per violation. It was part of the Biden administration's strategy to speed up vaccination rates as a way of fighting the coronavirus pandemic, which has now killed more than 800,000 Americans and affected the U.S. economy. The opinion said, "It is difficult to imagine what more the Occupational Safety and Health Administration could do or rely on to justify its finding that workers face a grave danger in the workplace. It is not appropriate to second-guess that agency determination, considering the substantial evidence, including many peer-reviewed scientific studies on which it relied." The Friday ruling immediately caused opponents to rush to the Supreme Court to ask it to intervene. South Carolina Attorney General Alan Wilson said on Twitter, "While we are disappointed in the court's decision, we will continue to fight the illegal mandate in the Supreme Court. We are confident the mandate can be stopped."
Monarchy is by definition incompatible with democracy. You cannot have a government chosen by election and at the same time have individuals occupying positions of power simply because they were born the sons or daughters of families who already have political power. It was on this principle that the English people fought a civil war, made a revolution, and cut off their king's head in the 17th century. When, after 10 years of being one of the first republics in the world, a monarch was restored to the British throne, it came to be understood that no king or queen would ever seek to rule without Parliament. Indeed, as Britain became a democracy, supporters of the parliamentary system insisted that the British monarchy has no real political power. The Victorian political theorist Walter Bagehot, for instance, wrote that the monarchy was merely a decorative part of the constitution and that real power was exercised by the cabinet. But even now, in the 21st century, is this really true? The royal family is, apart from anything else and beyond dispute, very wealthy, and money is one sort of power. And we pay for the royal family to remain wealthy. Their cost to the taxpayer has been estimated to anywhere between £40 million and £200 million. More than this, recent reports have revealed how much the royal family routinely seeks to directly and personally change the decisions of government. Here we look at how the hereditary power of the royal family still has an impact on the course of British political life.
The power behind the throne. Part 1.
oldest form of wealth in Britain is landed wealth. Long before there were corporations and banks, indeed long before there was a stable currency, wealth and power were measured by how much land you and your family owned. In medieval Britain, those who owned little or no land were forced to work for those who owned a lot of land. The National Trust and the Forestry Commission are now some of the biggest landowners. But astoundingly, in 21st century Britain, some of the largest landowners are the same as they have been for hundreds of years. The royal family and aristocracy, the Church of England, and Oxford University.
The largest landowners in Britain is the Crown Estate. They own a combined property portfolio of around £8.1 billion. That includes agricultural land as well as urban properties. And this isn't the monarch's personal private land, but she receives an annual percentage revenue from this every year.
Well, the thing about the monarchy is there are two kinds of ownership. There's the technical ownership, the ownership of 6.6 billion acres of land, i.e. the land that ordinary people around the world in their millions are standing on, living on, working on, farming on, and all the rest of it. And then you can get down to beyond the sort of the abstract and the deeds and so on. You can actually look at the actual physical wealth, concrete land that's owned in this country, in this country alone. Of the 36,000 landowners who own half the wealth in the country. Now, 36,000 might sound like a lot, but it's 0.6%. It's less than 1% of the UK population own half of the land. Of the top 10 of these 36,000 people, so the top 10 of those, Prince Charles is the third biggest landowner in this country.
The Crown and another 26 aristocratic estates own a total of nearly 1.4 million acres of land, over twice the entire land area owned by the National Trust, and nearly three times the total land owned by the pension funds in the UK. So the land owned by the Crown and aristocracy covers an area over three times the size of Greater London, or as third as much again as the total area of Cornwall. The Crown controls more than half of the UK's shoreline. Crown land is treated as a state asset, not to be sold by the monarch, and its revenues come to the state, and the Queen is paid a percentage of these profits. But the Queen can and does also own private property as a private individual in addition to Crown land.
There's a lot of huge estates which are still owned by members of the British aristocracy, including, of course, the royal family. There are also these peculiar feudal fiefdoms, which in a sense they are the Duchy of Lancaster and the Duchy of Cornwall, both of which are large royal estates. The finances of the royal family are very complex. There's a whole series of different revenue streams, and of course much of it is shrouded in secrecy. But there are two basic sources of their wealth. One is that they receive direct grants from the state to fund their official functions and big expense accounts as well. And then they have their own private property holdings, some of which is property which belongs to the Crown, some of which is the private property of members of the Windsor family. Balmoral Castle and estate and Sandringham Castle and estate, for example, are both the private property of the Queen as an individual, that is, the private property, if you like, of Elizabeth Windsor, rather than belonging to the Crown. But it's all terribly complicated, and people are left guessing at the actual wealth of the Queen. One estimate, I think, is that it's about £350 million, her private wealth, but it is an estimate because so much of this is shrouded in secrecy.
Crown land is some of the most valuable in the country. Indeed, the value of the Crown's urban property, £4 billion, is four times greater than the value of its rural land holdings. The Crown owns, for instance, the entirety of Regent Street, around half of St James's in London's West End, and retail property across the UK, including in Oxford, Exeter, Nottingham, Newcastle and Harlow. The Crown owns part of the Bluewater retail park in Kent. It also owns retail parks in Leeds, Milton Keynes, Merseyside, Slough, Swansea, Portsmouth, Harlow, Maidstone, Hemel Hempstead, Nottingham, Edinburgh, Warwick, Cheltenham and Jersey. The Windsor Estate controls Ascot Racecourse, golf clubs, hotels, farms and woodland. In Scotland, the Crown owns fishing rights on many rivers, oyster and mussel fishing revenues and mining rights throughout its holdings.
One of the problems with assessing the power of the royal family is that there is no constitution, there is no closely defined set of powers which members of the royal family retain. It's much more a kind of influence behind the scenes, which is quite difficult to measure.
The feudal Cornwall laws allow the Prince of Wales to claim the money and assets of anyone in Cornwall who dies without making a will. If they owe no money, the Prince of Wales can claim that for himself. He doesn't use it to put in his pocket, but his back pocket, but he does use it to fund his own personal projects, his own personal charities, and to fund bursaries in private schools. We know that so far he's claimed £3.3 million of other people's money. People have complained about this. The people in Cornwall have asked him to keep the money within the county and at the very least use it for the public spending and the public purse. He's refused to do so and ignores their requests.
In all, the £800 million Duchy of Cornwall estate provides Charles with £19 million worth a year in private profit. The royal family's whole property portfolio is estimated at over £7 billion, earning a tax-free £230 million in profit every single year. And that's before £10 billion worth of art collection is taken into account. With wealth comes power. Specifically the power not to obey the laws of the land in the way that every other citizen of the country is required to do. The Prince of Wales Duchy of Cornwall is not, for instance, subject to planning permission or planning consent in the way that any other builder would be. This means that Charles can avoid fines of up to £50,000 that would be levied against anyone else breaking these planning laws. Every other landlord has to grant squatters rights if they occupy land for 10 years. But for the Prince, that time limit is 60 years. Normally, landlords must allow their leaseholders to buy the freehold on a property. But not the Prince, who can hold leaseholders in that condition forever. The Duchy only pays tax voluntarily and has free advice from government lawyers. It also benefits from exemptions that no other private sector body enjoys. For instance, Charles pays no corporation tax or capital gains tax on his business enterprise.
The feudal Cornwall laws are pretty much an archaic and medieval-like remnant from kings and queens past. It allows the Duchy of Cornwall, that's the Prince of Wales's personal estate, to work as a separate legal jurisdiction. So that means that the Prince of Wales cannot be summoned in any of Her Majesty's courts. It means that he cannot be legally summoned to pay tax, and it means he's able to veto any law passed by government which may affect his private interests. And we know he has done this 12 times already.
Prince Charles has private commercial interests. If you take away this magic that is the royalty thing, if you take away the fact that he drives around in a big sparkly pram a lot of the time, if you take away that, he's a normal businessman with commercial interests. And I think it's right in a democracy that we should be able to see which commercial interests are trying to sway government policy.
Charles has long sought to influence many aspects of government policy. His letters to ministers have been kept secret by the Attorney General.
There are the sort of general privileges of the monarchy and the specific ones. The general privileges of the monarchy are pretty mind-boggling, really. Pretty much legal immunity across the board. I mean, there's been various sort of wranglings to make it possible to bring certain kinds of legal proceedings against royal family, but it's pretty much de facto impossible. And then, of course, there's the kind of specific privileges they have, which is we've seen with the so-called Black Spider memos. When you look at what the scale of these letters, it is quite worrying.
For a long time, there were suspicions that there have been suspicions that Prince Charles writes a lot of letters to ministers and other people, actually, advocating his, you know, his opinions and putting forward ideas on how the government should do things and, you know, how things should be changed. And these have gained the nickname Black Spider Memos because he's meant to go and write them late at night in his handwriting, which is quite scrawly. 10 years ago, 2005, the editor of The Guardian approached me and asked if we could use the Freedom of Information Act, which had just come into force then, to try and find out what letters Prince Charles had written to ministers and what they said and what their response had been. So we pursued it from then.
The government attempted to keep the letters secret in the face of a legal challenge from The Guardian newspaper. But recently, the courts ruled that the government had been wrong to prevent the publication of the Prince's attempts to influence government. When the Attorney General, Dominic Grieve, in the last government, sought to veto the publication of the Prince's letters, he did so, he claimed, because they would be seriously damaging to his role as a future monarch. If he forfeits his position of political neutrality as heir to the throne, he cannot easily recover it when he is king.
Prince Charles writing letters to government ministers is quite clearly able to get a hearing, quite clearly is able to influence policy. Some of the responses from government ministers which have come out have been quite sickeningly obsequious. A clear fawning by Labour ministers in some cases on leading members of the aristocracy, as if Prince Charles has some right over other citizens to interfere in the political process.
These letters were extremely rambling, they were very long and drawn out. He talks about so many things, all his kind of bugbears and his pet projects, everything from Irish jails to beef farming to herbal remedies to military supplies. There's pretty much nothing left that he hasn't got to talk about. Government ministers were very keen and quick to respond to Prince Charles. Tony Blair became a bit of a pen pal of Prince Charles, and I think the Home Secretary of the time, Charles Clark, he used to sign off these letters from your humble and obedient servant. So it just shows that the level of sycophancy and fawning that was his letters were treated with.
Charles has been writing these letters to ministers since Harold Wilson was Prime Minister in 1969. Charles wrote to ministers in Tony Blair's government no less than 27 times in just 8 months between September 2004 and April 2005.
Eventually we got the letters after 10 years. Now, ironically, the letters that actually were released were all typed, so we didn't see much of his scrawly handwriting. It took so long because the government resisted at every point disclosing the document, the letters. They fought, first of all, in a Freedom of Information Tribunal, which ruled against them. When they lost there, then they decided to use a veto, which blocked the publication, which overruled the court, the tribunal, and blocked the publication of the letters. So we had to then challenge that. And eventually that particular battle went all the way up to the Supreme Court this year, where the government again lost. So after that, there was no other legal avenue that they could pursue to try and stop the letters being published.
The previous Tory Lib Dem coalition spent hundreds of thousands of pounds of taxpayers' money blocking the Guardian newspaper's Freedom of Information request to see and publish the letters before the courts forced the government to back down.
What happened is that because the government were prepared to spend a lot of effort to keep the letters secret, they hired barristers to fight the legal battle at every turn, but they lost. But ultimately, all that the legal bill for that is more than £400,000 that the government has spent of taxpayers' money to stop the letters being released.
The reason is simple. The letters, described by the former Attorney General as particularly frank, have undermined the myth that the monarchy has no direct influence on government policy. They show that one man, simply because of the family he was born into, has an unparalleled access to the highest levels of government, access that is closed to any other citizen.
It's taken 10 years for these letters to come to light. It's 2005 that the Guardian started to put in freedom of information requests, and I think it's a very telling period because it was coming towards the end of Tony Blair's premiership. It was obviously in the wake of the invasion of Iraq. The tensions in British society were at a phenomenally high level, to put it mildly. It also came at the end of a period of nefarious arms dealings with Saudi Arabia that had gone back into the 80s and until 2006. Tens of billions of worth of arms was provided to Saudi Arabia that the monarchy, Prince Charles in particular, had helped sell. So it was a very tense period, and it brought to question all the kind of influence that happens in British society, from the legal system, from the Prime Minister's office, from the monarchy, and so on. And indeed, you can find hidden in a lot of these memos references to the state of military spending, which is obviously close to the heart of the royal family, making, as they do, so much arms trade from it. And also, they had a direct interest in the war going well, which of course it famously didn't.
Eventually, the letters were published, and they were letters over quite a short period of time, just eight months. The suspicion is that he's been writing for years and years. So we had a little snapshot. The public got a small snapshot of what he had been up to. And what they showed is that he had indeed been lobbying at the highest level, putting forward his point of view on particular subjects, wide-ranging number of subjects, and that he was lobbying ministers and even the Prime Minister.
The Guardian's actions in pursuing this story are practically unique in the history of British media. Usually the monarchy can rely on the British press to keep silent on any embarrassing story about the monarchy.
The royal family have a huge amount of influence over the press. They're extremely well connected, and the press pretty much acts as a universal cheerleader for the royal family. I think it was during the Jubilee that the Queen was taking a tour of the BBC studios, and live on air, so-called journalist Julian Warwicker bowed his head live to Her Majesty during the middle of a news report. And this really is unthinkable for a journalist to do. It just shows the level of fawning that we have within the establishment and within the press and within the media. So there's no serious discussion allowed about their constitutional place in society.
In the 1930s, newspapers in Britain remained silent on the relationship between the future King Edward VIII and the American divorcee, Wallace Simpson, the relationship that eventually led to Edward abdicating the throne. And they remained silent even while the news was being reported in the United States.
I think the royal family's influence over the press is considerable, and has probably in a way got greater, because the British media has become more and more obsequious, I think, over the last 20 to 30 years, much more reluctant to criticise, to expose what is going on inside the British establishment. Partly where it's state media, because they're worried about politicians restricting their funding, and in the case of the private media, because of the degree to which the newspapers and other media are controlled by top press barons, press lords, who of course are themselves leading members of the establishment and have very right-wing politics.
The tradition continues today. The contract with the BBC to film the wedding of Prince William and Kate Middleton stipulated that the footage could not be used for humorous or satirical purposes. Australian comedy programme The Chaser had to be pulled from the schedules because it breached that ban. During the making of a BBC One programme about the Commonwealth and the Queen's Silver Jubilee, a BBC producer said that it would not be suitable to interview Australian Prime Minister Julia Gillard because she is pro-Republican and would not fit the film's positive angle.
In 2011, BBC correspondent Frank Gardner was live on air, and he dropped something about the Queen. He said that the Queen was personally distressed about so-called hate preacher Abu Hamza, and she was said to be aghast at the fact that he couldn't be arrested for his anti-British values. And they reported on this, and then very soon afterwards, Frank Gardner, the BBC and the Director General issued a grovelling apology to the Queen.
Gardner told the BBC's Flagship Today programme, "She spoke to the Home Secretary at the time and said, surely this man must have broken some laws. Why is he still at large? He was conducting these radical activities and he called Britain a toilet. He was incredibly anti-British and yet he's been sucking up money from this country for a long time. He was a huge embarrassment to Muslims who condemned him." Gardner continued that the Queen, like anybody, was upset that her country and its subjects were being denigrated by this man. But there's the rub. The Queen is not like anybody, because not anyone can call up the Home Secretary and lobby them over matters that they find disturbing. Both the Palace, which refused to comment on the story, and the BBC instantly realised that they had revealed the still existing political power of the monarchy, a power that it's not supposed to have. As a matter of fact, the monarch does not need to make a special effort to get the government to hear her views.
The Queen is legally entitled to meet the Prime Minister once a week. If she can't meet him in person, she's allowed a telephone conversation. During these meetings, she's allowed to discuss anything she wishes, any matter at all. However, whatever she does discuss is kept completely confidential from the rest of the public. We do not have a right to know what she discusses on her behalf.
Tony Blair went further than most in his memoirs when he revealed that his first meeting with the Queen, she acted with hauteur, telling him, "You are my 10th Prime Minister. The first was Winston. That was before you were born." It's a telling few sentences. Clearly for the Queen, elected Prime Ministers come and go, but the monarchy is always there.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
In the limelight.
Thousands of previously hidden Pentagon documents show that the U.S. air wars in the West Asia region have been marked by deeply flawed intelligence and have killed thousands of civilians, many of them children, according to a shocking new report in the New York Times on Saturday afternoon, December 18th. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by the staff of Common Dreams website. This article is published under the heading NY Times says U.S. hit true toll of air wars. Thousands of dead civilians, many of them children. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. Thousands of previously hidden Pentagon documents show that the U.S. air wars in the West Asia region have been marked by deeply flawed intelligence and have killed thousands of civilians, many of them children, according to a shocking new report in the New York Times on Saturday afternoon, December 18th. The five-year Times investigation received more than 1,300 reports examining airstrikes in Iraq and Syria from September 2014 to January 2018, more than 5,400 pages in all. None of these records show any findings of wrongdoing on the actions of the U.S. military. The Times reporting confirms many of the previous reports by whistleblowers Daniel Hale, Chelsea Manning, and others. On July 27, 2021, whistleblower Hale was sentenced to 45 months in federal prison for exposing the true civilian toll of the U.S. drone program. Hale said at his sentencing, "I am here because I stole something that was never mine to take, precious human life." From the Times report, the trove of documents, the military's own confidential assessments of more than 1,300 reports of civilian casualties obtained by the New York Times lays bare how the air war has been marked by deeply flawed intelligence, rushed and often imprecise targeting, and the deaths of thousands of civilians, many of them children, a sharp contrast to the American government's image of war waged by all-seeing drones and precision bombs. The documents show, too, that despite the Pentagon's highly codified system for examining civilian casualties, pledges of transparency and accountability have given way to opacity and impunity. In only a handful of cases were the assessments made public. Not a single record provided includes a finding of wrongdoing or disciplinary action. Fewer than a dozen condolence payments were made, even though many survivors were left with disabilities requiring expensive medical care. Documented efforts to identify root causes or lessons learned are rare. The Times added, the air campaign represents a fundamental transformation of warfare that took shape in the final years of the Obama administration. Amid the deepening unpopularity of the forever wars that had claimed more than 6,000 American service members, the United States traded many of its boots on the ground for an arsenal of aircraft directed by controllers sitting at computers often thousands of miles away. President Barack Obama called it the most precious air campaign in history, unquote. Dr. Selrod, senior research fellow at the National American Council, reacted via Twitter saying, Daniel Hale, Julian Assange, Chelsea Manning have all been jailed for trying to reveal the same thing. We've known U.S. airstrikes have been killing civilians all this time, but the war crimes go on, B.C., we jail, the whistleblowers instead of the war criminals.
Simple question.
Who's really responsible for the deaths of migrants in the English Channel? The recent drowning of at least 27 migrants has led to renewed calls for a new approach to the ongoing crisis caused by those trying to start a new life in the United Kingdom. While British government officials claim it is on track to fix the broken asylum system, legislation has been criticised for making it harder for those arriving by boat to claim asylum in Britain. Those who speak refugees even say the new proposals are actually cruel.
There's a pattern to the problem. A large proportion of these migrants come from Iraq, Syria, and Afghanistan. All countries torn apart by conflict supported or even started by Anglo-American military escapades. Furthermore, while the UN Refugee Agency says deaths can be avoided with coordinated action, UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson and French President Emmanuel Macron have fallen out after the French President objected to Mr. Johnson's accusations that France has not done enough to stop migrants crossing the channel. The impact of these political and military conflicts has turned out to be lethal. War and conflict disrupt countries and entire regions, forcing migrants to flee. In their desperate efforts to start a new life, some pay traffickers large sums to assist them in their efforts to cross the channel to England. This leads to illegal immigration, increasing tensions between France and the United Kingdom, and deaths in the sea, while France and Britain blame each other for the migration issue and the human toll of those who drown.
To what extent is the UK responsible for the deaths of migrants in the English Channel? And who should be creating a new place for people to live after escaping from war-torn conflicts in which the United Kingdom plays a part? Simple questions with important answers. And we begin our inquiry with a straightforward and direct question. What does the public think of the deaths of 27 migrants who drowned while trying to cross the channel? We put that to the public here in London. This is what they told us.
A boat which is about the size as that one that goes up and down the river here, the small one. 27 people were on it and it capsized and they drowned this was last week. Yeah, and they just drowned and their bodies were washed up on the shore. Yeah.
It's so sad to hear that. Yeah, I mean, things like that should not be happening in the future, of course.
It's an absolute tragedy, and I just wish that there were actually legal safe routes for people to get to Britain in order to claim refugee status.
The way that we talk about, you know, helping people and things like foreign aid, but when there's real issues like people trying to escape persecution, I think it's shameful that the government, you know, practically ignores or tries to deflect the problem.
I mean, it's just a shame, really, isn't it? I mean, it's upsetting when anyone dies, let alone migrants. I mean, there's the whole... I'm sure like, an overwhelming majority are just trying to escape what can be just explained nothing short of an absolute travesty.
Sad and disappointed.
I don't think that's very nice to hear at all.
They have family, they have mother, father, sons, daughter, And I think we or the government need to pay the attention in that case.
I think it's a terrible tragedy. I don't think anyone deserves to die when trying to gain freedom and have the rights that we should all be given as human beings upon this earth.
Well, obviously, wasted life is always a tragedy. But it would not happen if people didn't get on broken lilos and try to cross the busiest waterway in the world in treacherous weather.
Horrific. And why don't we have a secure way whereby these people fleeing from Iraq, Afghanistan, Syria are able to come to this country? I think we've opened the doors to, is it 3 million from Hong Kong? Why can't we find a humane, civilized way of helping these people?
It's very sad. It's sad that they have to move, like, come over here and try and find, like, obviously living over here. Like, it's sad that they have to do that. They'd rather risk their life than just trying to find a better life where they actually are. I don't know, it's quite sad.
French government is responsible for us because that's their border. And then the British government should take in care of their English waters or English Channel to control the border. I think nobody should risk their life for better life.
It's terrible. It shouldn't have never happened in the first place. I mean, they should just have safe passage to prevent this to start with.
First, I suppose, used the word tragic, and it is a tragedy. Obviously, I think everybody can be completely sympathetic to the situation. And, yeah, of course, I think everybody was greatly saddened by the situation, considering there were children involved as well, which makes it even worse.
Many are refugees from conflicts fought by Britain, including in Afghanistan, Iraq, and other Middle Eastern countries. In the public's view, what responsibility does the UK have for these deaths?
I think we have a responsibility to provide safe passage for people to come here to attempt to claim refugee status. If we feel that we have the right to go and intervene in different ways around the world, then we have the responsibility to kind of follow up the results of that, I think.
Oh, we have massive responsibility. You know, it's anything that, you know, is initiated or guns that we sell to different parties in these conflicts is entirely, you know, the British government's responsibility to do something about it.
There's a very, very valid argument to make that to a certain extent, intervention in certain countries has worsened political situations. I mean, the arguable thing, you know, you can look at situations like maybe Syria or Iraq. Afghanistan is a very good one, I think.
I think we're responsible if we're involved in the conflict, but we're also responsible as a better-off country to help people who are not safe.
It's hard to pinpoint the exact responsibility if the conflict that they're running from is caused by the UK or at least contributed to by the UK. There's definitely some responsibility there, in my opinion anyway.
Well, this should be something that maybe the governments of the world should look at, and those of us who have more to give should be able to give and allow safe haven for these people.
I think we do have some responsibility for taking our fair share of refugees from conflicts that we've had a part in.
They're mainly refugees from countries which have internal problems, and that's why there was an influence from the British. And there are a number of countries that they could have stopped in along the way if they truly wanted somewhere that was just safer than where they came from.
These crossings are a consequence of us, so-called global Britain, meddling around in the Middle East. So we have a lot of responsibility.
I don't really know who to blame, but I'm pretty sure both sides should be responsible, like both France and the Britain part. Because is there a kind of shared channel, I guess, so...
There's some implicit responsibility because, you know, we've armed these countries, we've been involved militarily, and we haven't supported some of the kind of the transportation of the immigrants in the first place that were suffering in these countries.
That's a very loaded question. I think obviously they travelled many miles to get to the UK. Clearly, I think there's a lot of discussion about being housed in the first border call of whichever country they go to. Whether that's right or wrong, I don't know. I'm not an expert in that situation, but I guess if they do get to the UK, they're entitled to a hearing. They're entitled to the civil liberties, and obviously they're entitled to actually put their case forward. And that's the problem. I don't think they do get that. And perhaps the UK needs to have a rethink on that point.
Yes, some days ago, also, I heard about the problem in Afghanistan. I think that's something that is impossible to think in the 25... siglo. Century, sorry.
French police have been seen to watch on as many refugees board boats to cross the channel. What do people here in Britain think of the French allowing migrants to make these hazardous crossings?
The French police have watched on. They've been filmed watching on while the traffickers send the boats across. What do you think about that?
I mean, it's difficult because if they... I don't know, that's a tough one. Because if they stop them, then they stop them being able to try and find somewhere safer. But at the same time, it's not a safe journey either. But it's I don't know, that's a tough one.
From a legal perspective, it very well could be justified. From my opinion, that doesn't come across as right.
Yeah, I wish that there was closer and better tempered and more even collaboration between Britain and France and between Britain and the rest of the EU over this, to be fair. It's obviously not ideal that people are being allowed to launch themselves into small, unsafe boats into the channel. We've seen the result of that this year, so I wish that that wasn't happening.
If these start the war, obviously we should be taken responsibility for it. So, I mean, yeah.
The entire international community needs to take some responsibility and work together, like I say, to try and find a solution.
If you're seeing somebody getting on a boat that you know is probably not going to make it, I mean, in my opinion, I would be saying, don't make that crossing.
I think it's a responsibility of the French government.
Didn't see them to know if that's true or not. If it is, then they should be held accountable, but I haven't seen any evidence either way on that.
A very complex issue. I think it's wrong of them to not intervene, although there's always circumstances around everything. But I think there's always a duty of care to people, no matter who or where they come from.
I can't understand how we haven't taken back control from the French police.
I think that's part of the reason why they want to come over here, because they're just not getting looked after very well, clearly, either. If they're getting allowed to get on the boats, it's causing tragedies and they're allowing it to happen. We're trying to stop it and they're allowing it to happen and allowing them to come while we're trying to stop.
I think the British government, to be honest, because if you get involved in someone else's business, then there is always the consequences. So you have to face the consequences.
Basically, it's wherever they seek in, whichever country they look at to find asylum, that's where they should be housed in the first place.
I think what I probably would like to say, you wouldn't want to repeat, but I think that's absolutely disgusting. Clearly, if it's on the shores of the UK, we would expect the police to do their duty, and I think the same thing should apply to the French police.
The statistics underline the size of the issue and how little Britain is really doing to fix it. The Home Office plans to accept 5,000 people in the first year of the Afghan Citizens Resettlement Scheme, and up to 20,000 more afterwards. However, by late November 2021 alone, it is estimated that during this year, over 26,000 people, many from Afghanistan, had already arrived in small boats after crossing the channel illegally. Yet the Afghan conflict, in which the UK played a central role, generated 2.5 million refugees, of whom 2.2 million live in Iran and Pakistan, showing how small the UK's contribution is to fixing the problem it helped cause.
Who should be held responsible for finding new homes for refugees escaping conflicts fought by Britain?
I think a lot of responsibility therefore comes onto the government to make sure that we can give safe passage to these refugees and we can allow them in and look after them, as the conflict is our fault.
I believe they should have handled the issue like in a more precise manner.
Just because that's the country they went in first doesn't mean that country has equal responsibility for them being a refugee in the first place.
We're partly responsible, and countries should work together. Unfortunately, we seem to be global Britain going it alone, but we should work, like with the health crisis on COVID, countries should work together to solve these problems, be it climate change, refugees. It's a shame that we don't have anyone with any diplomatic skills from Lord Frost, Rab, Priti Patel, Boris, to make sure we are responsible global citizens.
It should be a shared effort between more governments, I'd say Britain, France, and whoever participated in those wars.
That would seem fair to me.
Allowing them to make the crossing, letting people make something that's unsafe where they could possibly lose their lives is almost like a criminal act. They're complicit in the deaths in a way by letting that happen. Yeah.
Well, again, I think it's down to probably every country to do their part. And we hear all the figures on the media. You never know whether you're hearing the right figures or not. Fairly obviously, I think other countries in Europe probably have taken more than the UK. And possibly the UK need to rethink their policy in that respect.
Who's actually responsible for rehousing people who've been victims of conflict that Britain itself has led or been involved in?
I think if people have refugee status in Britain, then Britain is responsible for rehousing them. We shouldn't forget that Britain has, I think, around about 1% of the world's refugees here. We have a tiny, tiny percentage of the world's refugees. And if we want to see ourselves as global Britain, as a country that has a role on the global stage, then we need to step up and take responsibility for some of this.
I would not like to comment on that, yeah, but these things should not be happen. I mean, if they are watching it, they should have stopped it, of course.
I don't want to just pile blame onto my own government. It's obviously the responsibility of all governments to try and find a solution for these people.
But it is our responsibility as humans, as common man, to account for one another. So not just the government, but we all, as a collective, need to step up and do something about it.
My opinion is, rather than trying to figure out exactly who is responsible, is that if you feel you can do something, and as a country, if we feel we can do something, then we just should.
What is the public's advice to the British government about refugees who risk death in the process of trying to cross the channel?
I think these practices should be stopped. I mean, force measures should be taken to stop it, because if the people are trying to cross the channel, they can lose their lives. So, yeah, of course.
My advice to government would be to work with people, with our friends and colleagues in the EU, to step up and to act more humanely, to give people safe passage routes.
If the government wants to, you know, be re-elected, they need to take action and do something about it.
There are plenty of people in the country who would want to help. It's just reaching out and maybe putting together a system where people who can help and can provide housing, or even if it's just temporary. You know, there's a lot of people with spare bedrooms.
Everybody knows it's an issue, and it's been an issue for quite some time. My advice would be stop ignoring it. Do something.
Let's try and find a way where they don't have to risk death, and we can help them if it is that we're responsible.
Oh, I think, Britain can help people who are homeless to find homes and so on.
I would say it's a very complex situation, but human life has to be saved amongst anything else. But I think rather than spending so much time trying to dissuade people from crossing, we should look at the reason why the people are going in the first place.
Work with other countries in a diplomatic manner to find a solution.
Should be able to give them set boats and, you know, better like accommodation to come over on, rather than just a dinghy that's probably going to sink halfway across. Like, we've got the boats, we've got like all the lifeguards and everything. We could be helping save more than anything. Do you know what I mean? We have lifeguards that swim the channels on a night time to make sure everything's all good. So we could be making things a lot safer, and communication with the other governments as well is even better. Like,
it doesn't matter what they're like, what country they came from, but their life matters, so they should be taken care of. They should have been taken care of.
Not all the immigrants are genuine immigrants. Most of them, they are economic immigrants. So finding ways to support them in their own country so they don't have to cross the borders. First place, if they have come over risking their life, then find the ways to settle them.
Here to safe passage. That's all we need, is a safe passage. They shouldn't be risking their lives in the first place. Otherwise, they are complicit in what's happening.
Again, I think we need to put something into place, a more meaningful policy in place to give these people a chance to have their story heard, to have their situation checked.
The 27 migrants who drowned in the English Channel as they tried unsuccessfully to reach British shores made the headlines. These fatalities also provoked a bitter war of words between British and French politicians after UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson attacked French authorities and, by implication, the French President himself, Emmanuel Macron, for failing to prevent the crossings.
Many make these dangerous journeys because of the impact of British conflicts on their homelands. A number of observers now believe that Britain must accept responsibility for causing much of the migrant problem. It seems a tragic irony that after travelling thousands of perilous kilometres from their war-torn homelands, desperate migrants seeking a new life drown within sight of the very country that turned them into refugees.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.